You filed for the Bahamas. Or maybe it's just a hop across Lake Michigan, or you're island hopping down the Florida Keys on a perfect summer morning with blue water stretching to every horizon and not a cloud in the sky. And somewhere in the back of your mind, you have already accepted it. If the engine quits out here, the runway is the ocean. I'm Pattern on Traffic Pattern right here on Radio Hangar. And today we are going to talk about ditching, not as a terrifying worst-case horror story, as a procedure, one you can study brief before every water crossing and execute with real confidence if it ever comes to that. Because here's what the accident record actually tells us. When pilots ditch with proper technique and even a little pre-flight planning, the odds are with them. Studies of general aviation ditching accidents over several decades consistently show that the vast majority of ditchings are survivable when the pilot had a plan and executed it. We are not talking about certain death out there over the water. We are talking about a serious emergency with a very manageable outcome if you have thought about it beforehand. And that is the key phrase. Beforehand. Let me give a quick shout out to our friends at aviationsoul.com before we get into this. They make challenge coins for every step of the pilot journey. First solo, private certificate, instrument rating, commercial, every milestone in this training path deserves to be recognized, and these coins are a great way to do it. aviationsoul.com. All right, let's talk about water. First, I want to speak directly to the pilots who are already mentally tuning out because they fly in the middle of the continent. I understand you look at a sectional of Iowa or Nebraska and you see a lot of green and not a lot of blue. But think about this. How many times in the past year have you crossed a river, a reservoir, a large lake? The Great Lakes alone cover nearly 95,000 square miles. Florida has thousands of lakes scattered across nearly every part of the state. And if you ever want to fly to the Bahamas, to Catalina Island, to Hawaii, or anywhere in coastal Alaska, you are crossing open water. This topic applies to more pilots than most people realize. And the Airman Certification Standards for Private Pilot require that you demonstrate knowledge of emergency procedures, which includes water landings. Your examiner can and will ask about this during the oral. So even if you fly exclusively over land today, understanding ditching makes you a more complete and more prepared pilot. Let's start where ditching actually starts, not over the water, before you leave the ground. Pre-flight planning for any significant water crossing is where you make the decisions that give you options later. There are a few non-negotiables. Life vests. Every person in that aircraft needs one. I know they are bulky. I know they live under seats and are easy to forget. But an inflatable personal flotation device runs somewhere between $40 and $80. That is the cheapest insurance you will ever buy in aviation. And if you are borrowing an aircraft or flying one you're not fully familiar with, physically locate those vests before you start the engine. Brief your passengers, and the single most important thing you tell them is this, because people consistently get it wrong. Do not inflate the vest inside the aircraft. Inflate it outside after you're clear of the cabin. A fully inflated vest creates positive buoyancy that works directly against you when the cabin is filling with water. You need to be able to push yourself down and out through the door opening, and a fully inflated vest can make that nearly impossible. Outside first, then inflate. Say it to your passengers. Have them repeat it back. File a flight plan. Even for short water crossings, even if you have flight following, a full flight plan means someone is looking for you on a schedule. If you go down and your radio and emergency locator transmitter both fail, that filed plan is what starts the search. Know your emergency locator transmitter. Where is it physically located in the aircraft? Does it auto-activate on impact? Can you manually activate it? If your aircraft has a remote panel, where is the switch? Go find out before you need to know in a hurry. And if you carry a personal locator beacon in your flight bag, those have saved lives over water, worth considering for any regular overwater flying. That is your water brief. 5 minutes before departure. And if the engine quits over open water, every one of those 5 minutes will have been worth it. Now let's talk about what happens when you're actually over the water and things go wrong. The first moment you recognize a serious problem, multiple things are happening in your head at once. You're troubleshooting the cause, you're checking altitude and glide range to see if you can reach land, and you're already starting to prepare mentally for the possibility that you're going in. If you cannot make land, the mayday call comes first. Not after you finish troubleshooting. Not after you confirm the engine is definitely not coming back. The call comes early. Mayday, mayday, mayday. 3 times. On your last known frequency or on 121.5, the international emergency frequency monitored by most air traffic facilities and search and rescue. Follow it with your aircraft type and call sign. Your position as best you know it, the nature of the emergency, souls on board, and fuel remaining if you have time. And squawk 7700. Here is something I wish someone had told me when I was training. You do not need a complete picture of the problem before you make the Mayday call. Even a partial call. Just your call sign and position gives rescuers a starting point. Make the call early. You can update with details as you have them. A complete call is better, but some call is infinitely better than none. Okay, you have made the call. You have committed to the ditching. The most consequential decision in front of you right now is this: where to land and in which direction. And this is where pilots who learn ditching only at a surface level get into trouble, because the instinct is to land into the wind, exactly as you would on a runway. That is correct if the water is calm and wind is light, but if there are swells, that calculation changes, sometimes significantly. The water surface is rarely as simple as it looks from altitude. Open water, especially on large lakes and coastal areas, almost always has a primary swell direction. These are the long, organized waves that come from the dominant wind or storm system that has been influencing the water. Then there are secondary swells running at different angles from a different source. Plus, wind waves on the surface, shorter and choppier. All of this is information you can actually read from altitude. The priority order for selecting your landing heading is laid out in the Aeronautical Information Manual and has been validated by decades of ditching experience. Wind is the first consideration. Primary swell direction is the second. Secondary swells and surface conditions are the third. Here is how to apply that in practice. If winds are light under about 25 to 30 knots, swell direction dominates your decision. Land parallel to the primary swell, even if that means accepting a crosswind. A predictable, stable water surface at touchdown is more valuable than eliminating crosswind. When you land parallel to the swell, you're riding along the wave shape rather than punching through it perpendicular. That dramatically reduces the risk of the nose burying and the aircraft cartwheeling. When winds are strong above 30 knots, the headwind component starts to dominate. At those speeds, the benefit of reduced ground speed at touchdown outweighs the benefit of a smoother surface. So you weight the decision more toward landing into the wind. If you have altitude to spare before you commit, do a recon. A single wide circle above the area lets you look down at the water surface and actually read the swell pattern. From above 2,000 feet, you can see the swell lines clearly, from 200 feet on final. You are mostly guessing. Use the altitude while you have it. One thing that surprises student pilots when we walk through this: the goal is not to touch down on a swell crest. The goal is to touch down in the trough, the flatter area between swells with the water surface running parallel beneath you. If you can time the flare to contact the water in a trough rather than on a crest, your touchdown is on the most stable surface available. That takes awareness and a little patience, not luck. Now let's configure the aircraft and talk about the approach itself. Flaps. Full flaps in most light aircraft for a ditching. This gives you the slowest possible touchdown speed. And on the water, every knot matters. The deceleration at water contact can be abrupt and significant. The water does not absorb energy the way a grass strip does. Slower is almost always better speed. Fly the approach at just above stall speed. Think of it like a power-off approach to landing at a short strip. You want the nose up at touchdown. The attitude should be slightly nose high so the tail contacts the water before the nose. If the nose hits first, it buries, and the aircraft can pitch forward violently. Tail first, or a very flat attitude, is what you're aiming for. Use whatever power you have available to control your descent rate. If the engine is putting out any power at all, even reduced, use it. If it is completely gone, you are flying a glide, same as any other forced landing. Manage energy carefully. You do not want to arrive over the water high and fast with nowhere to dissipate it. On short final, within the last 100 feet or so, a few specific actions. Mixture to idle cutoff if the engine is running fuel selector to the off position. Magnetos off, this reduces fire risk at the moment of impact. And here's the detail that can be the difference between getting out and not getting out. Your door, unlatched before touchdown, not swinging open, just unlatched. When an aircraft hits the water, the forces can distort the doorframe enough that a latched door cannot be opened at all. The pressure differential as the cabin floods can also work against you. Pop the latch, leave the door cracked. That is your exit, and you're guaranteeing it is there before you need it. Seatbelt and shoulder harness, tight, fully snug. Impact forces on water can be comparable to a hard ground landing. Brace, hands off the controls and pressing against the instrument panel or cross in your lap. Feet off the rudder pedals. You are protecting your ankles and knees from the pedal kick at impact. The aircraft touches. It may skip, especially if you had a little too much speed or contacted a swell crest. Let it stay braced through the skip and the deceleration. When the motion stops, you move. Here is what happens in the seconds after the aircraft stops moving. High-wing aircraft, your Cessna 172s and 182s, often float for a few minutes because the wings provide substantial buoyancy. Low-wing aircraft tend to sink considerably faster. Some aircraft will settle upright, some will nose over. Some, in certain conditions, will flip inverted. Here is something students almost never hear addressed in training. If the aircraft inverts after touchdown, wait a moment before you try to exit. The instinct is to thrash toward the door immediately. But if the aircraft is actively tumbling or inverting, you are fighting both the water and the momentum. Wait until motion stops. Take a breath if you have one. Orient yourself. Which direction is up, then exit. And that is a scenario worth walking through mentally on the ground, right now, when you have time and a clear head. Could you find your door handle in the dark, upside down, underwater, by feel alone? Probably not, unless you have thought about it. That mental rehearsal matters more than people give it credit for. Get out. Get clear of the aircraft, at least 30 to 40 feet away. A sinking aircraft can create a suction effect and pull things down with it. Inflate your vests. Now, outside, in the water. Activate the emergency locator transmitter manually if it is accessible. Stay together if you have passengers. Get on your back and float. Reduce heat loss by drawing your knees up and keeping your arms close to your sides. This posture, called the heat escape lessening position, meaningfully extends the time before cold water robs your core temperature. Even in summer, lake water can be cold enough to impair function faster than people expect. In winter or over northern water, the timeline gets much shorter. Use your handheld radio if you have one. If you have a signal mirror or any visual signaling device, now is the time. Stay visible. Help is coming because you made the Mayday call early. Now let's connect this to the airman certification standards and what you need to show an examiner. For private pilot, the ACS expects applicants to demonstrate knowledge of emergency procedures, including off-airport landings, and that includes water. Your oral examiner may ask you to describe the factors involved in selecting a water landing heading. They may ask about aircraft configuration. They may ask about post-landing actions and passenger management. The examiner is looking for systematic thinking under pressure. Walk them through it the way you would walk a nervous passenger through it. Wind, swells, and current in that order for your heading decision. Full flaps, minimum airspeed, nose-high attitude at touchdown, door unlatched, belts tight, mixture and fuel off before impact. Out of the aircraft immediately. Inflate outside. Emergency locator transmitter on, stay together. That is a complete, organized answer, and it shows exactly the kind of methodical decision-making that examiners want to see. Here is the practical exercise I recommend before your next flight that crosses any significant water. Pull up the route on your electronic flight bag. At each point over the water, estimate your glide distance from your planned altitude. A Cessna 172 glides roughly 1.5 to 2 miles for every 1,000 feet of altitude, give or take. Are you within glide range of land at all times? If not, is there something you can do about it? A slightly different routing? A higher cruise altitude for the crossing? The answer might be yes. The water crossing at this altitude is worth it. But you should know the answer before you take off. Not when the engine goes quiet and the silence fills the cockpit. The Aeronautical Information Manual, Section 6, covers emergency procedures and includes specific guidance on water landings. That section is worth an afternoon of your time, especially if you regularly fly near coastlines or large lakes. I'm Pattern. This is Traffic Pattern on Radio Hangar. Find us at radiohangar.com. Fly with a plan and fly safe.